Hi everyone and welcome to Life in Flux. I'm sitting here in my apartment in Istanbul putting the final touches on this interview with rock photographer Tony Mott, and I'm just listening to this back to this podcast and realizing what a goddamn powerhouse this guy is. I met Tony for the first time in 2017 at a tribute concert to my late father Bruce Begley. My father was in the music scene in the 1980s and 90s, and that's where he knew Tony from. It was fascinating to hear in this interview about his life, how he found photography, and about this golden period of live Australian music that was happening at Sydney in the 1980s. So this is Life in Flux, and I give you rock photographer Tony Mott.
Obviously a great city, but yeah, I just expect, I had this image of East meets West, and strangely, I've just been to Kathmandu and been disappointed. and that was my 21st visit to Kathmandu.
Wow.
And I've always said it's my favourite city in the world. It's just changed.
Why so many visits to Kathmandu? What captured
I've been to 90 countries, so I've been lots of places. And when I was a kid, I always wanted to go to Timbuktu and Kathmandu.
Yep.
Because of their names. I didn't really have any notion. And it sounds weird because I've been to so many places, but most places disappoint me, as in Istanbul.
Yeah.
Because my expectation is... Like, my expectation's probably way... completely unrealistic. Istanbul is obviously a fabulous city.
Of course.
That's not really a debate. But I expected something different, and it wasn't what I expected. It's modernness. And the fact that East doesn't meet West there... As in, like, completely. I think I almost wanted one side of the Bosphorus to be, like, completely Western and the other side be completely... almost like the, Byzantine area meets the Christianity or something like that. And, of course, it wasn't like that at all. But it's still obviously a fabulous city. Anyway, as I said, most places... Kathmandu's one of the few places I've been to, not disappointing at all. First time I went there, blew my mind. And the whole country did. And I've been there 20 times. But I went in 1996 was the last time I visited. So there's been a gap because of children and change of lifestyle.
Sure.
So I went late last year, and the terrorism, the Maoist terrorism and everything, meant millions have come into the city during that period of time. And the old roads that I used to know, I mean, I used to hire a push bike. I used to get around Kathmandu Valley on a push bike. No problem whatsoever. That's definitely not going to happen anymore. And there's a freeway between Baktapur and Kathmandu, which absolutely, I couldn't find the old roads. And I remember going to the, first of all, I arrived late at night and the drive from the airport to the city was like, where does this come from? And it was just all this suburbia and ugly suburbia.
Is this investment? I mean, did you look into it? Is this investment?
No. It's just the Maoist terrorism. The Maoist terrorism drove people who were frightened from the country. And Kathmandu just rose by 50% in 7 years. And it's now become this big city. It's still Kathmandu, and of course the earthquake hasn't helped. Earthquake destroyed Durbar Square. Kathmandu's, there's not a lot left of it. I was pleased to say Baktapur, which is the oldest city down the valley, has survived relatively well and is still has great character about it, but again, it's not the city it was. I used to push bike from Kathmandu down to Baktapur. It used to take me about an hour, and you went through the country to get there. There's no country between Kathmandu and Baktapur anymore. It's all suburban, all the city. It's almost one city now. So the six cities of Kathmandu Valley, I'd say four of them are now one.
So has it grown as in the city has expanded and just consumed all the villages? Is that what it was?
Yeah, no, the cities were Kirtipur, Patan, Baktapur and Kathmandu, and they had their own identity. Patan and Kathmandu were always close. I mean, the river separates them, but now all of them are just one city, even though they're not. You know, Baktapur still is called Baktapur. So I had a rotten time in the first week adjusting to... And I also went on the Annapurna circuit, which I walked in 96, and now there's a road.
Oh, wow.
And quite rightly for the locals that they've got a road, but it just spoiled the walk.
In the past, were you biking around the country as well? Riding?
No, I only push-biked in Kathmandu Valley, which sounds quite strenuous, but it's not, because it's flat as a pancake. You're on a plateau. I wouldn't be biking up the Annapurna circuit. It's difficult walking. I mean, you get up to... altitude where you're going. So yeah, you definitely. I would. But now there's a road.
Yeah,
I want to say a road. That's a very loose description to what they built. But it,
sure.
But it still means that it's not as isolated as it was. And from my pure selfish point of view, it's not what it was. And then I real also and again, this is going to sound dreadful, just purely from a selfish point of view. Nepal's developed a middle class. Which you never had in when I first went there. And so now there's Nepalese with money. Mm. And they are the tourists. And what I don't like about them is they dress Western. And I don't like that. When I went to Nepal, nobody in Nepal dressed Western when I first went to Nepal.
Mm.
And like, strangely, I had the same experience. My uncle, by marriage, went to Shanghai in 1981 and everybody wore Mao suits. Literally everybody wore white suits.
Wow.
Now, Shanghai, all the women are very, very fashionable. And it's just... Now, I'm not saying that's good or bad. It's just like...
No, it just
that's
is.
A hell of an image.
And
everybody in mouse suits.
Fashion trends can go around the world, you know, within months. You can see fashion trends from Australia translated in Istanbul straight away.
Well, you see, Istanbul, I want them to wear... Turkish uniform.
Fez.
Maybe not the fez. Maybe the fez is going too far, but I expect them to be more... I mean, even when you go into the country in Turkey, it's you're in the West. You're not in...
Yeah.
It's not...
Yeah.
It doesn't go on to Iran, Iraq, where you go into the country in Iran, Iraq, people are dressed traditionally in their clothes. And there is still... The other thing about Nepal that really pissed me off is selfies.
Oh, wow, yeah.
Every Nepalese kid is taking selfies. It's like, so my pleasure of doing
that,
photography in the early days was the candid photographer of children, because they didn't really know you were taking photographs because they didn't really have a concept of what photography was, whereas now no one doesn't know what a camera is, so everyone poses.
As soon as
you point a camera at them. So that was just a shock. But all of that shock is a selfish shock. I am aware that Nepal is a much better off country. There's less poverty and they've recovered amazingly well.
Less of a peasant
from the
class.
Earthquake. There was a lot of rhetoric on Nepalese TV about how awful Australia is. Nauru came up in conversation on television quite a lot.
They have these conversations when you leave Australia and you see how much the world is actually talking about us when things like this come up, especially the Australia's treatment of asylum seekers.
Nauru will not come back to bite us, but we should without a doubt hang our heads in shame.
Absolutely, yeah,
hang our heads in shame, and the fact that someone as despicable a human being as Mr. Dutton could be a prime minister, I find so appalling. It's very, very... I'm embarrassed.
And you read articles that are, say, attacking the Labour Party because they actually do believe that we should invite all the refugees here, like subverting the narrative that, the left-wing Labour Party is lying to the Australian public by having sympathy for these poor people who are flooding into the country, and that's why you shouldn't vote for them. Can you believe that?
The whole debate about refugees is one thing. Treating refugees on Nauru so appallingly is a crime. It's nothing less than criminal what has happened to those people on Nauru. Criminal. Nothing less. And when you consider the numbers, we are talking minuscule numbers. I mean, you've only got to go onto a beach on Greece and see bigger numbers any summer you want. It's not like it's a huge problem. It's like... Anyway, I've digressed, but it's... I find that...
No, it's a good digression, though.
Despicable behaviour.
Speaking of, because of course there's a huge issue of the Rohingya people that are escaping from persecution in Burma as well. You've travelled to Burma, haven't you?
I've been to Burma. I went to Burma in 1984, and I went to Burma 3 years ago.
What's the change there that you've seen?
Well, not a huge change. Not as a huge change as anywhere else, because obviously the military hasn't allowed too much change for a long period of time. I can never pronounce a name. Aung San
Suu Kyi?
Suu Kyi, whatever
her
name is.
I'm pretty sure that's right. Aung San Suu Kyi.
Her silence is deafening.
Yeah.
And one would like to know, is her silence because she really, really can't say too much because of the military? Because even though she's running the country as a figurehead, you do wonder whether it's... She couldn't agree with what's happening to the Rohingya people. I can't believe someone whose human civil rights has been violated for the best percentage of her life would condone it. And her silence is weird.
Yes.
Because she was never quiet. It's not one of her traits in the past. So it's a very weird, and I cannot believe she's not that she's changed, that she feels that, you know, that this is even remotely fair what's happening there.
Because I mean,
and when the monsoon comes, this is going to get back in the news again, because those people on the border. Bangladesh is not a funny place in the monsoon. No. Even with the Bangladeshis, every year they have huge casualties from monsoon. And a lot of that monsoon, and why it's got worse, is the deforestation of the Himalayas.
Oh, really?
So more water is coming down.
Wow.
I mean, basically the whole Bengali plateau is fed from the monsoon that hits the Himalayas. And, of course, the deforestation means more water comes down. So the floods get worse.
And
they can't cope with it.
When we're talking about Indian, Nepalese monsoons, that's serious rain.
Yeah, we're talking serious rain. By the time it gets down to the delta, we're talking. I mean, Bangladesh loses something like 20 to 30% of its land goes underwater every year. That's normal. That's not a catastrophe. That is normal monsoon behaviour.
Wow.
And now there's loads of people, like millions of Rohingya, living in little tents right in the monsoon path.
Mm.
And that's about to come up. We're only talking a couple of months away. Yes.
Bangladesh is at the front of talking about climate change as well.
I'm not surprised.
Yeah, they're one of these, as well as a lot of Pacific nations.
I would imagine the Maldives are in the same boat, thinking climate change is not such a good thing.
Exactly, yeah. And they've been trying to lobby their governments as well to do something and put away money for the future to invest in land to buy, to basically get their entire country out of Bangladesh. But whether that's going to happen or not to such an impoverished country... Yeah,
Bangladesh's problems are so enormous. Even if you were a dictator, and a good dictator, almost a contradiction in terms, but if you were, I wouldn't know how, if you were given all the power, how to solve Bangladesh, because of its geographical placement and its weather conditions. Its catastrophe is year in, year out, and there's... Buck all you can do about it.
And it shows that, like, actually how hardy human beings can be sometimes, that people can still live in such a dangerous area, like, for thousands of years and still hang on somehow.
Be
adaptable.
And, of course, Bengal, as in what Bangladesh should be, with Calcutta being India, as soon as you move slightly closer to Calcutta, less of monsoon damage.
Mm.
It's a pity the border's where it is.
Yeah, exactly. So did you see Kathmandu the first time from travelling through India? How did you make your way to Nepal the first time?
Good question. I'll have to try and remember. Oh, yeah, no. I went overland from India.
Okay.
I did Kashmir, Delhi, Agra, Varanasi, blow your mind, into Nepal. I went to Pokhara first in Nepal, and then went into Kathmandu on a gravel road. There wasn't any roads in those days, and it was quite a hair-raising road into Kathmandu, and then Kathmandu itself.
Was this early 80s?
82.
Okay. What was it that made you want to go overseas in the first place? Were you following the hippie trail?
No, it wasn't the hippie trail. I think I've always... Asia's my favourite destination. I think mainly because it's not Western, and it was just the difference. I mean, from a photography point of view, Kathmandu was always... Everyday life was interesting.
Yep.
So walking to the markets was just fascinating.
Mm.
No fridges. So housewives would shop three times a day to get... You buy your food, you cook it.
Yep.
You buy your food, you cook it. You buy your food, you cook it. Consequently, the markets were a hive of activity, so that was always interesting.
Fresh fish, actually in the tank.
Durbar Square with all the amazingly old temples with sadhus wandering around. The colour, the smell, the vibrancy. The other thing, of course, in early 82, I was living on like $30 a week, including my accommodation, and eating very well. So, it was cheap. The hippies had gone by the time I got there. Freak Street and everything had gone. Pink Floyd played there while I was there. They set up and played. Just fascination with just the whole culture and the whole difference. I've sort of studied Buddhism as a philosophy, not theologically, and I was fascinated with that. I was fascinated with Hinduism mainly because I'm very anti-religion. Nearly every, as in every religion. That doesn't mean I don't believe there might be something way bigger and incomprehensible to me. But I'm also fascinated by all religions. And Hinduism is, sure, of course, so... I mean, basically, the Jews, the Muslims, the Christians, they're all the same religion. You just get off the boat at a different period of time. Otherwise, it's the same religion. And then there's the byproducts, you know, Catholicism to Protestants to... You know, they're all different.
Course,
yeah. And the same with Islam, you know, the Shiites, the Shiites, they're all the same religion. But Hinduism, that's out there.
It's ancient.
It's completely different, and it has a completely different basis. And one wonders how India would survive without it, because without that belief, I don't know how Indians would continue.
Is the caste system dogma coming out of Hinduism?
The caste system has lightened up in the cities, but you go to India country, which is where the percentage of the people live, I think you'll find the caste system and the old ways still very much alive and well. You can't... the lack of education of India is one of its main problems, even though they are trying to address that. But I mean, and India, I've seen a massive change in India. The prosperity of India has been huge from the 1970s. I went to India in the 70s. I went to India before Nepal. I went to Calcutta in 1976, and that was an eye opener. Okay. That was just after Bangladeshi refugees came over there, and I saw dead bodies just lying in the street, and it was norm. That was pretty eye opening. But again, I was totally fascinated. I still love Calcutta. It's sort of gloriously shambolic. It's got more palaces than any other city in the world, but most of them are completely run down.
Haven't they? I thought they knocked a lot of palaces down in Calcutta.
No, they're just there.
They're just existing.
They may well have knocked a few down, but there's loads around. They're fantastic.
Wow.
They're like, you can see the ornate and the grandeur that was there anymore. Calcutta can't speak to the rest of India because they can't speak the language. They speak Bengali. The rest of India speaks Hindi. Hence, English is the national language because everyone can speak it. And Calcutta was the English capital. So, of course, when they got independence, Calcutta sort of missed out. They've got the only democratically elected communist government in the world.
Really?
Actually, I lie. Kerala, which is another state in India, also has a democratically elected communist government. And Calcutta's had one since the early 60s. And they've done a lot of good within. But Calcutta does suffer from being sort of isolated from the rest of India.
Is it the California of India, would you say?
No, definitely not. it's just isolated. It's a unique little... I mean, everything in India is unique. But Calcutta, yeah, it's... my wife produced a film called Lion, and we shot in Calcutta. And half the crew were from Mumbai, and they were Bollywood, and half the crew were local Bengalis from Calcutta, and it wouldn't take anybody could see the difference. All the Bollywood Mumbai crew were dressed in the latest designer dresses and clothes, and the Calcuttan crew were dressed in T-shirts and jeans, as the Aussie crew were, and never made the train meet. There was a lot of snobbery between the two.
Such a shame.
Yeah. I mean, the English class system and the Indian... the English class system and the Indian caste system are very similar.
Not yet.
There's a lot of that. A lot of that goes on. And I had an Indian friend who was a lovely girl, came out here. She married an English guy. And we went to a restaurant, an Indian restaurant on Cleveland Street.
Yeah.
And she immediately said, "Oh, these people are lower caste. Did you know that?" And I went, "I just eat here." And she was quite rude to them.
Did she explain how she knew?
She just knew. I don't know if it was the name or whatever. They were Indians from Singapore, but she immediately just said, "These people are lower caste system." And she said it in a very snobbery way. I thought, oh, she's being funny. She wasn't being funny. She meant it.
Wow.
And it's like, that's alive and well.
And that's just been drilled into them kind of from birth.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
Well, she's higher caste, so, you know, she ain't going
to
change.
Was that a move by a lot of lower caste Indians to move to Singapore and to
I think lower caste have moved
their own way?
I don't think it's... I think Indians in general have migrated due to the fact the country, particularly in the 60s and the 70s, I mean, there was an enormous Indian population in Uganda, which Idi Amin managed to change, and the same in Fiji. Indians and Chinese have migrated, but then again, when you've got the numbers,
you can make them count.
It's a place. You're gonna migrate.
And before we started recording, you said that...
I've said much about music, have we?
I was going to say. I was about to. that you started shooting.
Recording all this.
Oh, yeah, yeah, no, absolutely. Yeah. It's you've got to step into this thing with a bit of a candid note, I always find. It's the best way. Because you were before we started, you were saying that you started shooting photography because of India. Run me through that.
Well, my first travelling, I came out to Australia. I'm a French chef by trade, and I met some Australians in England, and they said you should come and see Sydney. It was 1976, and I went to Australia. The great thing about coming to Australia in 1976, Australia was the world's best-kept secret. There was no such thing as backpacking. That hadn't started yet. And very few people came to Australia on working holiday visas. They migrated. It was just the end of the £10 pom, and it was like people migrated. So I came here, and the first job I got was in Cremorne. And I remember distinctly going for the job, and it was exactly half the hours of chefing that I was doing in England.
Yeah.
And very close to twice the money. And he said to me, $120 a week, and I thought that's amazing. And I literally said to the guy, $120 a week, and he went, okay, 140, but that's the tops. And I was like, and it was a long weekend because I remember thinking, what the hell do I have to do to earn $140? And I worked like a trooper. Anyway, I discovered the music scene, which was phenomenal in Sydney and Australia in general, and I had a love of music. And on the way back, because I only had a year's working visa, I went back. I got this cheap ticket, and I went via India, and India, strangely, New Delhi and Moscow were the two places I went to. It was Aeroflot. It's very cheap. If you've ever been on Aeroflot, you'd know why. Anyway, I got to New Delhi.
Ryanair, maybe.
Oh, no, Ryanair's posh in comparison.
Really?
Oh, yeah. Wow. So anyway, I arrived in New Delhi with no real preconceptions, and it blew my mind.
Yeah.
Because it's like the smells, the people, everything. And all I did was New Delhi and Agra, and fell in love with the place. Just thought, this place is phenomenal. And mainly because it was just, I'd never seen anything quite like it. It was just phenomenal. Anyway, I ended up in Moscow, went back to England, and I knew this is the start of the Thatcher years.
Okay.
And England wasn't the best of places at the best of times in the Thatcher years, particularly. Great for punk music, but apart from males, I can't credit her for any other positives. Anyway, as a consequence of that trip, on my way back to Australia, I did a year's travel, and I flew London to Cairo, spent 2 weeks in Egypt to Pakistan into India, to Nepal, to Bangladesh, and it took me a year to get to Sydney.
Okay.
And I spent a huge year. And on that,
and this was in your early 20s, is that right?
Early 20s, I was in my early 20s. And a guy I knew, an art student friend, did these black and white portraits. And I just went, wow, that's fantastic. And I had a minor interest in photography, but as soon as I saw these 8x10s, I'd never seen a photo blown up 8x10 and in black and white and the grain, and I just loved it. And I made him, quite forcibly, to teach me basic black and white processing. I bought myself a Nikramat, a decent camera, and I just travelled with lots of film and processed all in black and white, and loved it and fell in love with photography from that day, from India and Nepal. When I got to Sydney in the early 80s, I'd now got a level of competence. I was certainly wouldn't ever been described as a good photographer. And so I had an interest in photography from that. No interest in taking photos in Australia. It was all in India and Nepal.
Wow.
Then I started seeing bands, and in the early 80s, bands had residencies quite regularly.
Of course,
I saw the Divinyls. Before they were signed or well-known, they played the Piccadilly Hotel in King's Cross every Tuesday night. And I'd go down every Tuesday night after work. And Chrissy Amplett, of course, was a phenomenal performer. And somewhere through the drunken haze at the front, rocking to the Divinyls, I was thinking, Jesus, that must be unbelievably difficult to photograph. She's moving, the light's going on and off. So the next week, I brought my camera along and started doing it. And in that six-month period, unbelievable crap photos was I taking. But I learnt through trial and error. And by the time the manager of the Divinyls, who saw me every night at the front taking shots, and he probably had a presumption that I knew what I was doing, I didn't, asked to look at the photos, which I ignored him for at least 2 weeks. And finally, I gave him a couple of contact sheets, and he bought one. It became a poster, and I became a rock and roll photographer.
What made you keep on turning up every night?
Like, I wanted to make sure I got it right.
Just get that photo.
I couldn't work out how to do it, as in the she was moving really fast, so it's really low light. Mm. And so I literally trying over. So I'd come home and there'd be nothing on the negatives. I'd think, oh. So then eventually, over a period of a long period of time, finally I started getting results. And luckily that's when the manager approached me, when I'd got a relatively level of competence. And the beauty, which I've only just, not that I've only just discovered, I've always known, is you never stop learning. Ever. But this, in that period of time, was an enormous learning curve. And I remember sending these contact sheets or going to see Vince Lovegrove, who managed the Divinals. And the one he picked out, I was like, really? You're mad. That's really. And there was a couple I was obviously proud of. He didn't like them, but he liked this one shot. And it was Chrissy with a mame of hair, and it's wild, and it became a tour poster. And it's now got the pride of joy in my house. It's signed by Chrissy. And I just realized then that photography, as all art, is subjective. And what they thought was great, and I didn't like, I shouldn't have judged it, because now I look back on it and go, wow, yeah, that was a really good shot. And I understand now, they weren't looking for the pin sharp, or they were looking for the wildness and the fact that it was slightly different.
To catch that in a moment.
And years later, I remember Morrissey, the Smiths, bought one of my photos and used it as a tour poster. And it's now in my book. And at the time, I was thinking, oh, they've picked the wrong one. They've said the wrong number. It was slightly out of focus. And it was like, and it really is very arty. And people have commented on it since and said, oh, that's really good the way. It's not arty. It was literally, I couldn't freeze him because of the low light and the movement.
Wow.
But I learned the lesson being that you shouldn't be judgmental of your own. Yeah, everyone sees photography. It's like music.
Do you know what it's like editing this podcast and hearing your own voice over and over again?
Yeah.
You want to throw yourself out a window. It's terrible. So when you found this the Australian music scene in the 80s, what was it like kind of to uncover this, you know, this whole scene just in front of you and you know, be a part of it?
I'd already spent time in New York and London, and I wasn't aware of it until I started seeing bands. And then it suddenly you were seeing really, really good bands. And the reason we had the golden age of Australian rock and roll is there was so much opportunity for the bands to play. A good example of that would be the Sydney Trade Union Club on Favreau Street, Surrey Hills. On a Friday, Saturday night, they had three levels of bands and six bands on each. So you're talking 18 bands. That's 36 bands over two nights are playing. I mean, they probably got paid $50 to be on at 8:30. The headliner on the third floor used to come on about 1 a.m, and there'd be four to six bands supporting. The Triffids' first ever gig in Sydney was playing on the first level on the carpet. They're fresh from Perth. You're having a beer and looking around and going, God, these guys are really good. So you just discovered music all the time, and there was so much of it. And of course, they were playing Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. So these bands honed their talent. They became really good live acts. They had to. And of course, not they were competitive with each other, but there's so many, you had to be good at what you were doing. The first time I saw the Hoodoo Gurus, they were the Le Hoodoo Gurus, and they were playing the Strawberry Hills in Surrey Hills. If there was 50 people in there, it's full. But, you know, and I think their lineup changed a lot. And there was Tex Perkins was in about 30 bands in 88, 89.
Getting passed around from band to band.
Some of them only lasted two or three gigs. And, you know, eventually, slowly but surely, the Beasts of Bourbon and the Cruel Sea came out of that. I won't say the better of all those bands, but the ones that had legs that would survive for a longer time. It was also a lot of indie music, as in it wasn't just mainstream. There was the mainstream acts as well, but there was a lot of the independents, the Go-Betweens, Nick Cave, the Birthday Party. All these bands were playing as well. I mean, it was just a feast of live bands. I mean, The Cure came in 1981 and played Sydney for 3 months and never played the same suburb twice.
Wow. Can you imagine that? You lived it.
I used to drive to Caringbah to see a band. I'd go up to the Royal Antle at Narrabeen, the Coleman Cutter at Blacktown. Every suburb didn't have a gig. They had two or three.
But were you more enthusiastic than the average person about seeing live music? Or was it just, it was the thing to do?
This is in the days of no internet.
Yes.
And
no Netflix.
And music was quite important. There was definitely an inner city crowd who tended to have a little bit of music snobbery. Like, yep. I'm trying to think of a case of a band. There was the Cold Chisels, the Midnight Oils, the Hoodoo Goos, Mental Tent, all of that. But there'd also be, for instance, the Radiators. The Radiators would be what you call a true blue Aussie pub band. And there'd be inner city people going, you're going to see the Radiators? There'd be a snobbery about them. Oh, they're just like mainstream rock and roll. Whatever. So there was a bit of snobbery about that. And then there was the go-betweens, the Triffids, Ed Cooper, all that inner city, Died Pretty and all that. There was crossovers, but there was a scene for everybody. You could do whatever you wanted. There wasn't a lot of pop. Mm. Not a lot of pop knocking around. It was mainly good, but it was fantastic. It was just, and because you mix with the same people. Strangely, Sydney, a good example of Sydney was, all these, you ended up at the Trade Union Club. Mm-hmm. You'd go and see a band at Carrying, wherever you went to see a band, the Harold Park, there's so many venues. And then about 1 o'clock, you still, I was a drinker. And there was literally the places to go with the Trade Union Club, the Judgment Bar in Taylor Square, and the Bank in Newtown. And they were the pubs that sort of served your ilk of people, as in inner city musical fans. Mm. And that was the only place. Strangely, I had children recently who are now 7 years old. And when they were about four, I got given a night out and I went out and I couldn't believe all these great new bars that had opened. Where the hell were these bars when I was a drinker? I was quite cheesed off. But they didn't have music. Mm. The music, like, every pub had a band. They play in the corner. And so it spawned what can only be described as the golden age of Australian rock and roll.
Yeah, and it seems like such a different time now. What are the things that have impacted the Australian music scene, especially the Sydney music scene?
Well, everyone's got theories on it, but there's no one thing impacted it. There's a natural attrition of life has changed. The internet has made a huge difference. Mm. Dance music came along, so there's dance parties, a different style of music, whatever. Everything changed. So the biggest changes were Sydney lost its radio station in Double J.
Okay.
Which every night you'd put Double J on your radio and they go, and the Go-Betweens at the Howard Park tonight. Ed Cooper's at the, you got your gig list. Melbourne survived that. So the country got a great radio station. Sydney lost a radio station.
Right. And was there an alternative radio station in Melbourne?
I can't what they're called now, but they've got two really good alternatives.
It starts with an R, I'm not sure.
I think it's Triple R is one.
Triple R.
And I think it's 3PBS is the other one. And they are very, very listening. You walk into anybody's house, it'd be on and they'd have a gig list. So they gained a national radio station in Triple J, which is, and I'm not knocking Triple J, good thing that they did, but Sydney lost one.
Yes.
Around the same time, the fire regulations came in.
Right.
So that made a huge difference. Around the same time, RBT came in. And so all of a sudden you can't drink and drive. This sounds really crazy, but literally, that made a difference. So people aren't going to go all the way over to Newtown, all the way up to Narrabeen to see Midnight Oil, get pie-eyed and drive back. They're going to get done. So all those things, and I should also emphasise, I remember throwing in the fire regulations, all the pub owners were basically, this is where the government should have stepped in and given everyone the money to do it. Because basically landlords were going, I've got to spend $100,000 on a fire exit to put bands on who were a pain in the arse, they do a sound check. So lots of them just went, and the pokey machines came in. So all those things happened.
Yeah.
And also the internet happened, and so lots of things changed. So the world just changed anyway.
Yeah.
But I remember when the fire regulations came in, and I was having a bit of a moan about it, and I was doing a shoot with Ed Cooper at the Sydney Trade Union Club.
Oh, yep.
And we're talking about the fire regulations when the girl I was with, the journalist, said to me, so there's a fire here on the third floor. Where are you going? Get out. And I went, and all there was the stairs. It was a death threat waiting to happen. Nothing ever happened there. And the fire exit went
made old timber as well.
Yeah. And it was like, So obviously they were a good thing. And random breath testing. It's not like I'm knocking it. It's a good thing. We don't want people drinking and driving. And that. So, but all those things. So the world changed overnight.
Yeah, exactly.
Not overnight, over a period of time.
Speaking of, I read a couple of years ago, we're talking to the ABC about how it's just not possible for you to make a living off shooting musicians anymore and live gigs. How does that kind of feel that the world has changed so dramatically and it's kind of affected your career? really?
Well, luckily, I lived in the golden age of doing it. And when I was the official photographer for the Big Day Out. And around the year 2000, the headliners were Nine Inch Nails, Foo Fighters, and Red Hot Chili Peppers. And I would have 160 to 170 music magazines around the world on my books. And so I would email them. I did a photo. I remember it well because I did a photo session with Anthony Kiedis and Dave Grohl together.
Yep.
No one else did it, just me. So I emailed all these magazines, and out of the 160, I think about 20 or 30 of them bought the photograph. It made a cover, two covers, and you sold it around and you syndicated a bit. And Australia had, each city had two or three street presses, mm-hmm. and then there'd be Duke Magazine, Ram Magazine, Rolling Stone. There was all these outlets. So anyway, that's the year 2000, Big Day Out. 160-odd music magazines. Around 2007, I had my children. I had twins, and I stayed at home for a couple of years. I wasn't working hard. Around 2009, I toured with the Big Day Out again. By complete coincidence, Red Hot Chili Peppers were on the bill.
Mm.
Of those 160 music magazines, 150-odd of them had disappeared.
Wow.
Didn't exist anymore. America doesn't have a hard copy music magazine apart from Rolling Stone left.
And I was just
every city used to have one in America.
I can't. So, it's unbelievable.
So they all just disappeared.
They all just went. Everything pre.
The internet had arrived, but people on the internet didn't seem to want to pay for photos. They seemed to think they were entitled just to have them for free.
Yeah.
And so everything just changed overnight. Getty Images didn't help. Getty had a huge campaign to take over the world photography-wise and started lowering the price of photos, and so they devalued the art of photography, as in the price. So, but not all these things I'm saying, not one of them is responsible. They're all responsible combination of a period of 5 to 10 years. So consequently now, I just shot the APRA Awards, the Music Awards, and they had a wall there, you know, Midnight Oil, Casey Chambers, Paul Kelly, everyone lines up against it. And there's about 20 photographers there doing the wall. And I remember just looking, thinking, where are they selling to? There's no way they're all making good money. I'd imagine that a lot of them are doing
magazines
it.
Like Women's Weekly, a couple of gossip mags.
I can't say the same thing. I remember being on the Big Day Out. I used to work with a publicist on the Big Day Out, and the Big Day Out would say, "Oh, we've got 80 requests for photographers," and it'd be like, "Really?" And you go through them and you go, "Who are? Where are they? Where are they?" Yeah, and you'd go.
Because I was just reading this morning that Rolling Stone Australia shut down in February.
Yeah.
And how sad is that? I mean, it's such a loss. All these print or online, all these magazines, they all provided so much content besides music as well.
Yeah. No, it's sad but inevitable.
Yeah,
it's not like any of us can come up with a solution. I do believe the government. Obviously, the government always is last to think about anything. But the film industry is heavily subsidised.
Yes.
And we have quite a relatively prosperous film and TV industry. And it's subsidised. You get when they make a movie,
available.
There's grants and you get tax rebates, etc. Yep. And it keeps a very vibrant industry. The music industry really should have been, particularly the live scene. I mean, obviously, Baird and his lockout laws were just unbelievable. I had a case. Rolling Stones played out at Homebush, and they always have to have. Keith always liked to have a little bit of a lick after gigs, and they asked the basement. Rang the basement up and they said, you know, and there's never a guarantee they're going to turn up.
Oh, this is going to be such an embarrassing story.
Well, it's an embarrassing story. It never happened because the Stones on that particular occasion didn't happen. But had they decided at 1 o'clock to turn up, the law said they wouldn't have been allowed in.
Oh,
because
they're
not coming in after time. Yeah. And lockout laws for the basement? I mean, as the basement, I don't remember any trouble. I've been to the basement at least 200 times. I have never, ever seen any trouble apart from a couple of bands having blues backstage about who was out of tune. But apart from that, I've never seen any trouble at the basement. Why are they part of the lockout laws? You know, and the general, you know.
And how the Crown Casino is just, you know, funny enough that it's actually excluded from the zone as well.
Does anybody ever ask how many suicides are in the Crown Casino a year?
No. That's inside the Crown Casino?
Yeah.
Wow. Or people just drinking themselves to death?
No, I think it's the last gamble.
Oh, horrible. Oh, well, there's another casino coming up soon. So, look, maybe they can split the statistics. Yeah, exactly. So, what's it like? So now, what do you look forward to? Now that you've kind of moved a bit away from music as far as your photography, what are you working on now?
I do TV and film. I do stills on TV and films.
Okay.
I married a film producer who I met on a film. Paul Goldman's one of my best friends.
By the way, we didn't even touch on the fact she worked on that huge production Lion.
She worked on Lion and Top of the Lake.
Okay.
I did the stills in Calcutta for Lion. Anyway, the... I forgot what I was going to say then. Paul Goldman, who was famous for putting Kylie Minogue in hot pants, he shot all... he was Australia's first video maker in the 80s. He's been an old friend. And when he made his second feature film, Suburban Mayhem, he got me to do stills on it. And that was my... not that I opened the door, because I wasn't really interested. But basically, I ended up starting doing stills on TV and film. And
well, that's great.
It's a very, very different... form of photography, and it's quite enjoyable, but it's very different.
Yeah, no, I can very imagine. Different. Was your career? It seems to have a lot of momentum about it.
Well, the main momentum was my. It's very strange because there has been points where I was described as Australia's number one rock photographer.
Yep.
And the reality is, I never was. I've never been the best, but there was times when I was the most prolific.
Yeah.
And the prolific being, I shot everybody and everybody, and I wanted to.
By sticking in there.
I stuck in there, and I wouldn't go away, and I shot literally everybody. There wasn't anybody I didn't want to shoot. So I was prolific, and my photos ended up everywhere, but there was always photographers. Photography, like I said, is very subjective, and I've never felt competitive with other photographers. But I've looked at other photographers and said, like Wendy McDougall, for instance, who started around the same time, I've never ever not looked at her photos and gone, wow, she's amazing. She's always, every time I see her work, I always go, yeah. And she was basically competing with me for the same jobs, but I never felt competitive, mainly because whoever's hiring us would look at her photos and they'd either want her style or my style. They're different. It's a bit like you're going to have a party tonight and you're a Metallica fan. The chances of you hiring Lucinda Williams are nil. But they're both apparently musical acts, but they're not competitive because it's just completely... Well, photography is the same in so much as people have styles and they're just different styles. But I was prolific, and mainly because I had an enormous obsession with music.
Yeah, yeah.
And I just loved it. It was never, ever a job. It was always a pleasure. And I used to go on and I also... The other thing about the whole thing is that music scene... whenever people ask me my favourite all-time bands, particularly Australian bands, let's just go for Australian bands.
Sure, sure.
I always name my favourite Australian bands. They're very easy to name. Is Divinyls, Tex Don and Charlie, Die Pretty, Cold Chisel, Midnight Oil. They're easy to name. But also there was an indie scene. And my favourite all-time Australian band is Temper Temper. You've never heard of them.
They used to
play the Piccadilly at the same time as the Divinyls did. I think they were the Thursday nights. And to this day, I think Rob O'Connell wrote some of the greatest pop songs. Rob would... Probably wouldn't forgive me, but I don't care. He was always difficult to deal with, and he did get offered record deals, but he was always so difficult he never got deals. There was the Honeys, who I used to go and see with an obsession. I just thought they wrote the greatest songs with a girl who had the golden voice, and they never crossed over to mainstream.
Is that funny?
They're just two bands. I could name 20 more in that ilk, and that's how great the scene was. That those bands didn't happen, as in go through the stratosphere, because it was such a huge marketplace. There was so much going on.
Is that because you've got a unique perspective? You see so much live music. You're there as a photographer and as a fan. Is it strange to see bands that just can't put it together? You know, for some reason,
this is always the beauty of music and bands. And there was a lot of people, particularly idiots in record companies, who never did ever work out. I think the greatest thing, example of it, was Killing Time, Mantissa. Uh-huh. They were signed to Red Eye, and they just had everything going for them, the look and everything. But the one guy who, in all the photos, looked a little bit cumbersome, a little bit overweight, a little bit, was the genius of the band. But the record company couldn't see that, and they said, if we replace him with a really good looking lad with long hair, it's like, that doesn't work. It's got, if you take Keith out of the Rolling Stones, they're not the world's greatest band anymore.
Falls apart.
If you take Mick out of the band, it's not Charlie, they're all little, and it's that beauty of life that John Lennon met Paul McCartney, and God knows why they were the genius they are together. Meeting George Martin, that's another thing, that just timing.
Yeah.
Why was George Martin, who'd never done rock and roll, never done pop music, was more into the classicals, suddenly got the Beatles, and the rawness that he saw of them, and that combination of the genius of John Lennon and Paul McCartney. And John Lennon and Paul McCartney, my God, they're worlds apart, but the combination all worked. The same with bands. Any band, Midnight Oil, obviously a huge percentage of the public would just see Pete Garrett. Sure. Understandably, he's the visual thing, and he's very charismatic and the whole bit. But my God, that's a band.
Oh, yeah. That Jim Magini.
The whole band is a band. And
the drummer.
There's a couple of... Rob Hurst. He shouldn't be allowed to hit sticks that hard. But that is a band. And it is it's not genius. It's like... for whatever luck they got, that those guys all met each other and that combination worked. And if you take a couple of cogs out of a band, it doesn't work. Mm. And there's loads of... I'll tell you a great example of how it doesn't work. No one would ever say that Led Zeppelin's not a great band. Great band.
Sure.
Jimmy Page, genius, great band. I don't know if you know a band called Free, but for me, Free were the greatest blues rock band that England produced, and the lead singer was Paul Rodgers. And most people in England regard Paul Rodgers as the greatest white blues voice.
Mm.
Free split up. He went on to form Bad Company, Paul Rodgers, and they became successful.
Wow.
So Bad Company split up, Led Zeppelin split up. Jimmy Page and Paul Rodgers are friends, so they put a band together. Now, on paper, go, Jimmy Page... And Paul Rodgers, without a doubt, a better voice than Robert Plant.
Mm.
Greatest blues voice, great combination. They formed a band called The Firm. Shit is the word to describe them. And yet, there's two guys there. How does that happen? For whatever reason, The Firm just didn't work.
Butting heads, or just two creative people that can't make it work?
They'd know more than I'd know why it didn't work. And they only did the one album, and they did the one tour, and they don't really talk about it too much. But at the time, everyone's going, Paul Rodgers with Jimmy Page, how great is it? It didn't work. Who knows why it didn't work, but it didn't work. There's just combinations. When David Bowie found Mick Ronson... That worked. I mean, without Mick Ronson, David Bowie would have taken a lot. David Bowie would still be the genius he is, but he would have taken a lot longer to get to where he was going. But when he met Mick Ronson, for whatever reason, that worked.
Mm.
Who knows why it didn't work?
What's worked? Tell me about some times where it hasn't worked with musicians you've tried to shoot, and where it has, and what you learned
From a photography point of view.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
Well,
trying
from
to
a photography
draw
point of view,
out of those artists.
Oh well, photography's got completely different to the music, and. A lot of musicians would see photography as a necessary evil. Elvis Costello would be an example, who really has no interest in having his photograph taken, but he's very aware he's got to. And so you have to do it really simple. He doesn't want a lot of trouble. And it's, as I say, he thinks it's a necessary. There's other bands. Little Birdie would be an example of Katie Steele goes to a lot of trouble in advance, talks to you, I want this, I want this, I want that. Michael Stipe. Totally into photography. Three guys in the band, they'll sit there and don't do nothing. So the way it works is Sarah McLachlan, the management were very clever and said to me, she's rehearsing, you can go to rehearsal, you'll meet, go to dinner. We collaborated on what we were going to do, and it worked. But then you get the things that go wrong. I've done shoots with the Church, and Steve Gilby and Marty Wilson have got definite ideas of what they want. I had ideas, and my ideas didn't sync with their ideas, but we still tried to do something, and it never really worked. And it would be fair to say I've let the Church down in so much as I haven't given them what they were looking for. And it didn't. The combination didn't work. Wendy McDougall's done some great photos of the Church, and many people have.
Is that hard, getting out of your own way as a photographer? You know,
no, it's not getting out of your way. It's trying to get on the same wavelength. It's a collaboration.
Okay.
Strangely, another one that I've always felt I've let down is Paul Kelly. I've never felt I've got a great photograph of Paul Kelly, but at the same time, Paul Kelly's Paul Kelly. It's not going to make any difference to his career.
Yeah.
And he's used my photos on a regular basis, so he's not obviously unhappy with them, but I've never felt I've captured Paul Kelly.
Yeah, of course.
And there's a few I've failed on, without a doubt. It's just, sometimes you connect and sometimes you don't connect, and sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. But there's no, you know, when you're photographing that many people, the two art forms of rock and roll photography are in two. There's live and the session. When you're doing live, the good news is the musician's in their natural environment. The bad news is I've got no control of circumstances, as in people, punks jumping on my head, or the lights going on and off. When you're doing a session, I'm now in total control of the light and the circumstances, but I've taken the musician out of their natural environment.
Yes.
So I've got to try and get some comfort. And I'm trying to capture an image that says something about their music. I'm trying to look for their soul. I know that sounds weird,
no.
But that's what you're looking for. And sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't work. But there's no one can do it. Ever. You just can't do it. It's just impossible.
Yeah, yeah.
You shouldn't get ever demoralised about it. It's just, you know, when it works, it works. The thrill of when people ask me, which do you prefer? Oh, when it works, it's great. When it doesn't work, it's not so great. Both live and session, they're just different. But and of course, in the days of film, there was a less of a percentage of digital's easy because it's so susceptible to light.
Do you scoff at modern photographers that have the chance to use that don't use film?
No, it is what it is. The first time I used digital, I got a sense of cheating because it was so easy. But at the same time, it's also a thrill because you go, oh wow, this is great. There was times when you were shooting on film where the lights were so low and you were pushing your film so far and you literally knew you weren't going to get anything. You may as well have gone home. That there was without a doubt. That was not uncommon. Whereas now, I can shoot under candlelight because of digital. And that's great. But obviously, the level of skill in photography has gone down as a consequence.
Sure, of course. So it's interesting, this obviously love for travel and adventure that you seem to have that has kind of coincided in this very unique career that you've crafted for yourself, really. Passion come from? Where did this passion for travel and taking the world by the balls come from, huh?
I suppose the passion for travel was the first time I ever travelled, I just went, I was thrilled. It was like brilliant.
I loved the
difference to go places and go, wow, this is different. Even when you don't like it, it's great. I don't like seeing the homogenization of the planet is something I really dislike.
Seeing that shopping mall that has the exact, that's in every city and has exactly the same shops, Dior, et cetera, et cetera.
The fact that there was no such thing as Coca-Cola when I went to India the first time. Now, here's a great trivia question. Where on the planet can you be the furthest from a bottle of Coca-Cola? I should point out, I haven't got an answer. Because when you're in the middle of the ocean, there's container ships going backwards and forwards. They'll have bottles of Coke on them.
Yeah, of course.
The Antarctic has got Coca-Cola. Russia now has Coca-Cola. So where's the furthest point on the planet from a bottle of Coca-Cola?
Of course, there's that movie, Have the Gods Gone Crazy, where a bottle of Coca-Cola changes the people of the Gobi Desert. Is that right?
Yeah.
Kalahari, maybe. Yeah.
I'm not knocking Coca-Cola. I drink the stuff. But it's just that homogenization. When I'm in Mongolia, I want Mongolian food that I think's crap, as in I can't eat it, but it's Mongolian. I like the fact that human beings are different, which is not... And tolerance is, of course, the biggest thing that the world needs, is if you want to believe that the dog is God, then yes, you're right. And I'm not going to condemn you for it. And it's like the religion, you know, when all the religious... I met a musician the other day who was Catholic upbringing, and I was talking about my wife's got a film out at the moment, Mary Magdalene, and she goes, oh, she was a prostitute. I said, well, actually, the only evidence of that is some Pope in the 4th century decided to call her that because, you know, women were getting a bit up themselves.
Oh, of course, it's come through dogma,
And he was quite shocked by that, and I was thinking, oh, God, that's exactly the point.
Yeah,
I don't know how I've digressed to the Catholicism or whatever.
I love it.
But that whole, the homogenization of the planet is not... I love difference. Difference is great. I went to Mali and Timbuktu 5-6 years ago, and that was fantastic. That was really different, and seeing Saharan Africa was interesting.
Have you seen that he was popularized through Facebook, I'm pretty sure, the Humans of New York photographer?
No.
He started off taking photos of interesting people he saw in New York and just asking them what they were doing, and they'd give these detailed accounts of amazing or horrible things that had happened. And he ended up, he's taken that idea through Syria, through Turkey, through the refugee crisis, to Greece, through Africa as well. And, given us, like, having a photo and giving just a quote or a little story from everyone.
Oh, no, I'll have to look that up.
Yeah, no, it's just an interesting... It's an interesting thing about what you're talking about being able to capture a moment in your photography.
Yeah, it's and, just, yeah.
Yeah, and these people and where these people are in their moment of time as well. What kind of projects would you like to move on to in the future?
I want to go to Burkina Faso in Africa.
I have no idea where that is.
It's in West Africa. Unfortunately, after Libya was liberated, all the Al-Qaeda has gone across the border, so it's not really safe to travel there. I'm busy... looking after two seven-year-old twins.
Yeah.
So that's the main part of my life, and doing stills on TV. But I'm still travelling. We're off to Paris and England with the kids later in the year. And like I say, I will go to Bucani Fresco one day. I just don't want to be shot at. I don't know why. I just not like it.
Touring and being into the Australian music scene, was it ever detrimental to your health? Did you ever get pulled into anything a bit too, just partying too hard or anything, enjoying yourself?
I probably drank a little bit too much in the 80s and 90s. Yeah. I've never done a drug in my life.
Okay.
Literally not a single drug. Not from any moralistic point of view. When I was growing up in the 70s, the only drug available was marijuana.
Mm.
And all the potheads seem to just sit in a circle and go, whoa, a lot. A bit like Neil from The Young Ones, old reference. So that never really, I was always a bit hyperactive. And when I had a good party, I'd be dancing at 6 o'clock in the morning without drugs. So I never needed the need for cocaine and stuff. And so by the time I got to the 90s, it just became a thing where, oh, I just never done drugs. So I never did. So drugs, I've never had a problem with drugs, as in, because I've never taken them. I probably drank too much at some period, but not that I was a bad drunk. I used to just dance quite silly, I've probably got a few memory brain cells have gone as a consequence.
Just on the piss of it,
but no, I never felt any danger. I the biggest danger I've ever had at a rock concert was the Wiggles, because I was at the front taking photos of them, and then all these 3-year-olds, and I came rushing to the stage, and you can't tell a 3-year-old to stop being excited. And my arms, I was scared that my elbows, if I go like that, I'm going to take a 3-year-old out, and I was very nervous. And I saw a massive Maori security guy, and it petrified him too.
And that very well leads to my next question. How has being a father changed you? How has having kids kind of affected your life?
Well, I have life pre-kids and life post-kids.
I think a lot of people would say that.
The cliches are all there. I suppose you love them not way too much. I was about to say you love them way too much, but you love them so much it hurts.
Mm.
I feel like, because I've got twins and a boy and a girl, I feel like I'm living in a social experiment, watching the difference between the two of them. Difference, it's just a huge lifestyle change. My wife and I play a lot of tag team. So one of us is...
Yeah, you make it work between the two careers.
It just changed completely. But it's just a different life, but it's glorious. I love it. And I'm glad I did it when I did it, because I would have been a dreadful father in my 20s, 30s and 40s, because I was ambitious and work was be all and end all. And not that I considered rock photography ever as work. I've never counted the hours. It was always a pleasure. But it was what I did.
Good to get all that crazy life energy out.
And right now, I'm quite focused on looking after Harvey and Lucy.
As you should be.
And they'll probably diss me in about 5 or 6 years. Still got control, or relative control.
Before it all changes, yeah. How we first got in contact was from What a Life, your photography exhibition that's going around the country at the moment. Where is it now?
It's between Port Macquarie and Albury.
Okay.
It may well be on the road between Port Macquarie and Albury. And then it goes to Canberra, and then it goes to Darwin, and he's coming back to Sydney. It goes to Liverpool. It's going to the Casula Powerhouse Museum.
Wow.
Early next year.
Okay.
And then there's talk about going to Melbourne.
Wow.
But it's always talk.
What's that like, looking back on your... Putting this exhibition together and looking back at your collection of work?
That's a good question.
This big phase of your life that was...
I curated it in so much as I picked a lot of the photos, but I didn't really have a lot to do when they were putting it up and how they were doing it. A girl called Louise Tagar, who deserves an enormous amount of credit for the exhibition, more so than me, even though it's all my work. It's her exhibition. She put it together and she did a magnificent job of curating it. And I tend to be hands-off, as in I don't like to be... She consulted me all the time and I may have pissed her off by going, no, no, you do what you think's best. And I did have a couple of things. I mean, the idea of the Chrissy Amphlett wall was mine and stuff. But anyway, when it came to the opening at the State Library, I went down the day before it opened. I was gobsmacked. I didn't realise how massive it was. It was in 5 big rooms and they'd done such a good job. And it was... At the same time, it's very weird because I know all the photos, so I don't get the thrill of going, oh, wow, because I go, well, it's mine, I've seen that. I always prefer other people's photos because I've not seen them before. But the way she'd laid it out, I was completely thrilled. Then the opening night was a big thrill because lots of people were there and people are very nice and say nice things. But the biggest thrill was towards the last couple of weeks. It grew in its popularity. It started, I think, in October, and it did really well. But by the time it finished last week in January, it was mobbed on the weekends. And the second last weekend I went down there, and it was packed. Wow. And all these people were coming up, and it was quite thrilling because all these people, the one thing that, oh, I went to so-and-so gig, I went to so-and-so gig, and people were reliving that golden era. And it was quite a thrill to people's reactions. They were just looking at this, and it was, and you realise it's important that it's documented that that was a golden era. And one of the best rooms was, we put a room called Sydney Sounds. And while there was, the main rooms had massive shots of, you know, Madonna, Elton John, In Excess, Divinyls, Coaches, all the usual, Prince, David Bowie, Usual Suspect. They had this room, and it was bands like Box the Jesuit, The Hummingbirds, Front End Loader, The Honeys, The Killjoys, Falling Joys, all those bands that literally kept Sydney alive with this great music scene, and they all had their following. And that was the one that got a lot of reaction, that people were coming in going, oh, God, I love them. How come they didn't do this? And what we said before is, why weren't those bands bigger than they were? They certainly should have been. There's lots of reasons why, it was a thrill to see that, and it was good that the State Library allowed me to put in what wasn't mainstream. Often in the past, when galleries, of course they want the Rolling Stones, Madonna and Elton John, and then you say, oh, I've got a Box of Jesuit, and they go, pardon? Hang on, I've got Box of Jesuit, and they go, oh, I don't really know. Yeah, that doesn't. I don't care that you've not heard of them. They were fabulous. Box of Jesuit are one of the most fabulous bands that Sydney ever produced. Tim Rogers, particularly, is a huge fan of Goose, and he was a huge Goose. The singer, apart from his unbelievable stage presence, was just a huge music fan. He had so much music knowledge. Again, this is just hindsight and thinking, but had Box the Jesuit gone to London when Birthday Party, Go-Betweens? It's very important, not so much the Birthday Party, because they had a relative following, but the Go-Betweens, Triffids and all those bands, they did nothing in this country. They were the same as the Honeys, the Falling Joys, the Front End. They were the same. That's all they ever got in this country. They moved to London.
They had to get out.
And London loved them, and Europe loved them. And they got them. By the time they came back as sort of conquering heroes, they got a bigger following. But when they were here, they weren't that big. None of those bands. And Box the Jesuit would be an example of, I think they might have taken London by storm. I think they would have been a much bigger band than they have. I mean, obviously, they weren't a big band. They were a cult band. But, my God, they influenced a lot of people.
Yeah. I mean, your role has kind of turned into a bit of a historian now, a bit of a keeper of the keys as far as a lot of...
There's a few people around.
What was happening?
There's a few people.
Era.
Well, that's what the exhibition was about to begin with, to try and document what we had, and it's pretty important. I did a shoot with Tonight Alive, who have done relatively good business, and they're huge music fans. And at the end of a photo session, I was doing these photos for them, and we were having a beer afterwards, and I just said, and they're from Blacktown, I just said, I suppose your dream would have been to play the Comb and Cutter. And they all went, what? I went, the Comb and Cutter. They'd never heard of it. And these were people who were totally into music. And the Comb and Cutter. And it dawned on me, oh, my God, the Comb and Cutter's gone. Of course it's gone. So it's a Bunnings, by the way, at the moment. And then I just thought, these are early 20s kids, totally into music, and they don't know about it. And I remember them looking at me when I started going on about the Trade Union Club, and I could see, what is this boy and elf fart going on about? Over their heads. And I thought then, that was my first thing. I thought, this has got to be documented. And I approached Louis Degas. I said, I think it's pretty important that this period should be documented, and hence the exhibition.
Do you ever walk around that exhibition, or just even see old photographs, and you still see the imperfections, or you still see photographs that you go, oh, God, I wish I could have got that light just perfect?
I see my own incompetence all the time.
That's a way to phrase it, yeah.
But not really in so much as... Most of the photos you see are the ones that worked.
Okay.
So, my famous shot of Johnny Rotten with a halo, it was my third attempt at shooting it, because the halo was this fluorescent that gave off so much light. So, of course, I've got plenty of stock film of the crap attempts at it. So I discard them and don't let people see them. So the imperfections, not really, because the imperfections don't make it onto the wall.
The cream doesn't,
the one thing I do get a sensation is, God, what would I have got if I'd have had a digital camera back then? Because I've got a couple of David Bowie shots that are fantastic, but they're literally the only shots I've got. You shoot under a very low light, and I've got like four or five good shots. Digital, I would have had like a library full of
them. Yeah, it would have been a new age.
But maybe it's more precious to have a few than many.
Yeah, absolutely.
There's a great line that I always think for art in general that Ralph McTell talked about. I've forgotten her name now. Great poet from the 60s, Sylvia Plath. And his line for Sylvia Plath was, "There's only a few that can say it for the many, and they're very good. But there's only a few that can say it for the few, and they're the special ones." I always think that's great about art and the cult, the ones that are only popular with a certain amount of people. I just thought that line really resonates about music, that there's only a few that can say it for the few, but they're the special ones.
And what a perfect place to end it right there. Tony, thank you so much for coming in. It's been an absolute pleasure hearing about
I have
about
waffled
the...
a lot.
No, that's what we want. I'm just trying to get out of your way to get to these amazing stories you've got to tell. Thank you so much for joining me.
Oh, and if anybody wants a book, books are available on www.tonymott.com.
Cheers. Thanks, Tony.
Thanks a lot.
Wow, see what I mean? That guy is just a dynamo of knowledge and experience. It was all I could do just to keep up throwing in a comment and a question every now and then. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Tony Mott. A big thanks to Tony as well for coming on and speaking to me. I do hope you enjoyed this episode of Life in Flux. If you enjoy what we're doing, please do go to iTunes and leave a comment or a review. It does help us get noticed in the podcast game. My name is Jesse Begley, and this has been Life in Flux. We'll see you next week.